Welcome to Resettled Radio, brought to you by the ARCC, live on Planet FM.
Stay tuned for current affairs, conversation, interviews, music and more,
as we explore the perspectives and stories from resettled communities.
And bring you information from within the resettlement sector.
Welcome to Resettled Radio, brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM. I'm Galwa Schultz. This week is the storytelling week, and we have some stories for you. I hope you will enjoy. Thank you.
I was born in Eritrea. My family moved to a camp in Ethiopia and stayed there for nearly 2 years. I came to New Zealand together with my family at a young age at the end of 2003. First we went to Mangere, and from there we moved to Henderson and lived there for almost 5 years. I was 10 at the time. I went to Ranui Primary School for 2 years. I needed a special status in primary school. In New Zealand primary school, you should leave primary when you are between 11 to 12 years old, but because I didn't speak English and I didn't know how to read and write, my teacher advised that I should stay for one more year to improve my English. My teacher helped me with all the foundations that I needed to enter intermediate. I stayed only 1 year behind because I was getting older, and people in New Zealand ask, "How old are you?" And when you tell them, they start teasing you. I wrote a letter to the principal explaining my situation and why I wanted to move to year eight. She approved my request. In 2008, I finished Henderson Intermediate and moved to Waitakere College, where I studied there until year 10. I was very interested in studying, so I used to work hard and try to improve my English. I didn't go to school back home. I started learning the basics here, from ABC to science and maths. By the time I went to high school, I still had difficulties in English, but I knew the basics of math. I used to read the children's books just to improve my English. ESOL classes also helped. I had that one-to-one help. That was really good because they helped students with writing, spelling, verbs, nouns, pronouns, and other parts of speech. Those are the basics of the English language that one needs to learn. It was hard for me as I didn't know the English language and didn't learn it from a young age. My English improved through school. I received second place for the top class, top scholar award in 10th grade. I got almost 5 awards within a 2-year period. I was also given a special book only awarded to hard-working students. I was very happy for my achievements in school. In year 11, I moved to a different school, and that year was difficult for me. I had a lot of family problems. In the middle of such problems, I still had an interest for studying, but because there was a lot going on with my life, I struggled with classes. I still got prizes for schoolwork, but it was a very challenging time for me. When we first came from Mangere, we got our own home and started going to primary school. It was different for us because all the students remained seated when the teacher entered the classroom. My culture had made me believe that students here needed disciplinary action because they acted differently from the way I was raised to think a student should behave in a classroom. We asked ourselves, what are they doing? In our country, students sit at the table, and when the teacher comes into the classroom, they stand up as a sign of respect. It's different in New Zealand. Students were all white people. We thought we looked different. I remember this girl. She was so beautiful, sitting next to me, playing with her braided hair. I couldn't stop looking at her, wondering why she was playing with her braids. Some people have someone who inspires them. I have one too. My primary school teacher has inspired me in many ways. I will never forget her. She knew that I had English language deficiencies, so every time we were on break, she would tell her daughter and her friends to teach me things that I needed to know. She wanted me to achieve more, so she gave me all the help that I needed. She believed that I was a very bright student, and if I stayed back a year, I could improve and would be more confident and be able to achieve whatever I wanted. She trusted me, and I trusted her. After high school, I went to the Auckland University of Technology. I enjoyed studying health sciences there. I learned so many new things. I got to experience life as an adult and learn to deal with things on my own. My first preference was to get into medicine, but having English as second language is a struggle. I didn't get all the scores required, so I didn't get into medical school. I applied at Auckland University of Technology and I went for the health science pathway. I chose health promotion psychology papers in my first year. When I compared the papers, I liked the psychology part better because health promotion is more about promoting awareness, whereas psychology is studying the human behaviour in depth and how to implement interventions. I liked it because it connects me more with people. Also, it is similar to being a doctor if I continue and do my master's. Perhaps I may still get into medicine someday. I would like to work with youth. That's my wish. Some youth leave school at 16, so I need to promote the importance of education to them and its benefits in the long run. I want to work with youth or as a career advisor at a university because many students don't know what their options for courses will look like or what the requirements are when one is pursuing a course. One wrong step may ruin the whole process. I consider myself a lucky person to be in this country. There are so many beautiful things I like about it. First of all, New Zealand is peaceful and safe. It also provides more opportunities for immigrants. When I say more opportunities, I mean that I get a lot of support from different government sectors, education, healthcare, and housing. One gets student allowances and student loans to study at any university within New Zealand. The country has lots of opportunities for people who have the drive to go out there and do something with their lives. As a new immigrant in New Zealand, there are some things I dislike though. It is a small place, but the culture is different. Back home, your neighbours are like family. They say hello to you and you say hello to them every day and they come to your house and you go to their house while sharing a lot of things. But here, you don't care who your next door neighbour is. Everyone is on his or her own way, sometimes without any greetings. That is the only thing I don't like about New Zealand. People need community. You need people's support. I know there is support. For example, if you go to church, that is where you can meet people and there are youth programs, but I do not think that is enough. You need a lot of support in your society from neighbours and friends. For people who have no family here, they have a very challenging and difficult time. There is this issue of speaking English. If you cannot speak the language, they will make you study English to make it better. But some people don't want to study because they never studied back home. To tell them to go and study English, their mind might not be in that position. They came here to live in a safe country first, and they want to find work. And I know it is beneficial to learn English, but also to find a part-time job. I know some immigrants from refugee backgrounds who go to school but want to depend on social welfare assistance, and that is not a good idea. It's fine to get government support, but it's important to try to find part-time work to support yourself while studying, because welfare assistance will not solve all your financial needs. Some people end up on social welfare financial support because they cannot find any jobs. They are made to depend on government support because they don't have a job. I think that is why people don't want to stay in New Zealand nowadays. There is racism, and a lot of people move to Australia to work there. There are more job opportunities in Australia than in New Zealand. Here, you find companies demanding experience for the simplest jobs that don't require any experience. My question is, how is a person entering the job force expected to have work experience? I say, give someone the work so they can show you their skills. According to the things I have experienced in New Zealand, I have advice for new settlers from refugee backgrounds. If you have children as young as 11 through 16, try to have an honest discussion with them about the importance of school. Students of these ages don't always take school seriously, but parents can give their moral support. They should use every opportunity that is given to them wisely. Such age groups don't easily listen, but try your best. It's not always easy to settle in a new country, but you can be fine if you are prepared for it. Let your children use the opportunity to study. The thing is that you get more opportunities and benefits after achieving a good quality education. Suppose you come from a poor country in which all you knew was war, hunger, diseases and other disasters, and you come here to abuse freedom and opportunities provided to you. Are you doing something for yourself? That would be a waste of resources to bring you here. Ask yourself questions like, why did you come here? What can you do for yourself? What do you want to achieve? There are many reasons for different immigrants to come to New Zealand. Refugees come to New Zealand to be safe and live a happy life. New Zealand is a safe and peaceful country. Like I said earlier, some immigrants come here for different reasons. Whatever the reason is that brought you here, you should manage your time and use it wisely. Yes, you can still socialise, but you need to make time for upgrading your life. Have time periods for each activity you do. I really don't like it when people waste the time that should be spent on useful things. For the older people, don't just sit home doing nothing and complaining. Give your free time to communities by volunteering. Helping communities through volunteering doesn't require English language as a prerequisite, so get involved in volunteering programs. All you need is to find the right connections. Build on your previous experience and skills and knowledge to find whatever you want in your life. Everyone has something to offer. In New Zealand, you need to be brave to tackle lots of obstacles, challenges, and difficulties to reach where you want to be. Whenever you complain about not having something in your life, there is a place and a time for that. Think, if I do this right now, what will be the consequences? All the people that I have met have different life experiences, different ways of living. They have suffered a lot in their lives, but in the end, they got to where they wanted. Don't think too much about people who are bothersome to you. They are a distraction. Just mind your own business and move on. Remember that patience, resilience, and perseverance do matter. My coming to New Zealand is a great success. From a young age back home, I used to live on a farm. It was a hard life. The purpose of moving to New Zealand is to live a peaceful life and get a quality education. There were a few times where life was tough for me and I was tempted to quit school to find a job, earn money and move back home because in my own interpretation, back home you have your own culture, your own people and everyone would be around me. But the question is, would I be safe if I returned to my country of origin? I dropped the idea. When I was a little girl, I used to tell my dad that I don't want to live in the countryside. I always wanted to go to the city, get an education and become a doctor. I wanted to have an educated husband and I wanted to have a nice house. That is the only dream I had and I was given the opportunity to come here and get all that. Here in New Zealand, I am educated, I have the dream husband I wanted and I am currently working towards getting my dream home. Mission accomplished. WCZ, you know it's mo easy. You know easy to do as easy. Now who do the busy? Don't go by cheesy. Money go. Now who do the beat? Oh, don't go by cheesy. 2 years ago when I was in Mushin, some of them there, you mo, me see. What you love, one more flash, one more classy, one more from one and one. Enjoy my love, bini bini. Come follow me, spend my money. Money, my love, bini bini.
Originally from the Republic of South Sudan, which separated from Sudan on July 9, 2011, after I had already resettled in New Zealand as a new settler. 21 years of the deadliest civil wars on the African continent occurred from 1983 to 2005, resulting in Sudan split into two independent countries. Millions of people died. Tragically, South Sudan entered its own civil war 2 years after it gained its independence from Sudan, and this war is still ongoing. Only God knows when the fighting will stop. South Sudan is rich in oil, minerals, and other natural resources, but poor in infrastructure. People only know and hear about the war side of South Sudan, not its beauty and natural resources. I am the eldest son in a family of 5 boys and 3 girls. My father was a well-known builder in our area. My mother was a housewife, but both of them were also farmers. Panyidwe Paju, our village where I grew up, is not far from Malakal, capital of the Upper Nile State. I always traveled between Panyidwe Paju and Malakal. My father was a traditional Sholok, who held very strong Sholok values, norms, and beliefs. Sholok is one of South Sudan's 64 tribes. We, the Sholok people, live along the west and east bank of the White River Nile and Sabad River. We have been ruled by a divine king for centuries. We hold strong customs. Our Sholok king, which we call Reth, is the head of the tribe. Although the Sholok are settled communities along the River Nile, we are pastoralists. We keep herds of cattle, sheep, and goats, but largely invest in subsistence farming. My family owned 1,000 hectares of land with cows, goats, and sheep. The community viewed my father as a rich man and treated him with high regard. I lived in Malakal for school purposes and would only come to Panyidwe Paju, our village, during the school holidays. I was responsible for my books in Malakal, but I immediately assumed the responsibility of our livestock when I was in Panyidwe Paju. I grazed cows, goats, and sheep for several hours in the open fields of Savannah grasslands, while making sure that the naughty calves didn't stray from their mothers. I would keep my eyes open for any wild animal that may attack them. With my traditional spears, I had to face any lion that may attempt to attack the cows. If I lost one to any wild animal, I would be severely punished. This is where my responsibility started as a young boy. Life was simple, but happy. Life turned ugly in 1983 when the Second Sudanese Civil War broke out between the government forces and South Sudanese armed rebels known as Sudan's People's Liberation Movement. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement was fighting for an independent South Sudan, but the government in Khartoum was determined not to allow Sudan to break up into two countries. The Sudanese government sent its military combat forces to Malakal to fight Sudan People's Liberation Movement and turned all schools into military barracks. On the other side of the river, which is adjacent to Malakal, was home to armed rebels. All the Sholok villages were made into military barracks by combative forces. We became displaced people in our own homes. No school, no farming, and no animal grazing. The insecurity was on the rise. Sudan went through two civil wars. The first Sudanese civil war was fought in 1955 to 1975, and the second was fought from 1983 to 2005. These wars caused the loss of more than 3.5 million lives and many millions of displaced people. One life lost during the Civil War included my grandfather, Ajako, who was killed in 1971. My father was killed in the Second Civil War in 1989. The wars took a huge toll on our family. As a result of two opposing military forces occupying entire communities, South Sudan was not safe anymore. The government of Sudan and rebels were fighting in our land, the Sholok land, and the results were devastating. Civilians were killed indiscriminately. Women were raped. Even girls as young as 9 years of age were not spared. The rebels were carrying out a massive recruitment of young people against their will. The warring armies committed atrocities. In this political atmosphere, my father believed that there was no future for me in Malakal. He didn't want me to be conscripted into the army of any side. One day my father told me, "Son, I have gone through the first South Sudanese civil war in my life and believe the answer for all these military conflicts in South Sudan is education. I want you to go to Sudan, where it is more peaceful, and stay with my brother." Moving to North Sudan at the age of 13 meant vulnerability, and although I would be an internally displaced person there, life would be better in Khartoum than it would have been in Malakal. I went to Northern Sudan with my young brother, William, and my maternal grandmother. We settled in Haj Abdullah and lived there for 9 years as a displaced minor. I started my education there, but it was difficult to cope with the different cultures in one country. Schools in North Sudan used Arabic as a language of instruction. There had been more English classes and less Arabic in Malakal, so I had to learn more Arabic. Education in Sudan was more about achievement, with a high level of competition among classmates in the Sudan education system. It took me a few years to improve my Arabic language so that I could pass my classes with good grades. While in school, I also worked in a restaurant. The money I got supported my younger brother and me. I saved some money and started a small business. My father had taught me how to fix doors and windows in residential houses, so I was making money in a construction business while teaching part-time as well. The year of 1989 was not a good year for me. I received bad news about my father. He had been killed by Nuer tribe militia who occupied our district of Dolib Hill. They had killed other relatives as well. I felt so shocked to hear the tragic news. As I was going through the grieving process, I remembered his words of encouragement. He used to advise me to take school seriously, as it will be my future. He wanted me to go to university, so I decided to put education first in my life. A big part of his legacy was the value he placed on education, and as the eldest son in my family, I thought getting an education was the best way to respect my father. I still believe that education is everything in my life, and that through education, I could live my father's dream, not only in school, but also in my daily life. The system in Northern Sudan treats South Sudanese people badly for being Christians. There has not been freedom of religion since Sudan was turned into an Islamic state in 1985. In North Sudan, you have to be a Muslim to receive equal treatment. If you are South Sudanese, you will be treated as a second-class citizen. On August 3, 2000, I went to Syria. I was pursuing educational opportunities while trying to find job opportunities as well. I was lucky to get a few construction jobs to support my siblings and my mother back in Sudan. As I got used to Syrian culture, I got a good job. I was employed as an assistant manager at Khalil Al-Daya, Oriental shop in Syria. It was a big shop, and I worked 7 days a week, except for 3 hours I used for church service on Sundays. I worked my bones off to maintain myself. Through this job, I was able to pay my bills. Life improved a bit. With the little money I made, I was stepping into my father's shoes. As the firstborn in the family, I needed to fulfill my role. I must take care of my whole family. In 2001, I was nearly deported back to Sudan against my will by the Syrian authorities. The Sudanese government didn't want any South Sudanese to stay in Syria on the grounds that the South Sudanese people may sabotage the government in Khartoum. The Sudanese government ordered, through its bilateral relations with Syria, to deport all South Sudanese who lived in Syria without a stay visa, whether they were under the protection of the United Nations or not. That was a huge number to deport. All South Sudanese protested against the decision and urged the United Nations to protect the refugees. We were all rounded up and crammed into Syrian military barracks awaiting deportation. Everyone was a prisoner. I stayed in the Syrian prison for 3 months and 10 days, under inhumane treatment. It took me 5 years to get refugee status under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees local office in Damascus. The process to claim protection under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Syria was a long one. Patience and perseverance were the guiding principles that kept my head up. In 2005, 5 months after getting refugee status, I was asked to resettle in New Zealand. This came as an emergency case. I felt so happy about this decision because this would also mean that I would be able to receive further education in New Zealand and find employment opportunities. I finally had hope that this could be the beginning of a better life for me and my family. In 2005, I arrived in Auckland, New Zealand. I came with my two daughters and my lovely wife, Mary. We stayed in Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre for 6 weeks, after which time we also received an orientation program organised by the New Zealand government. When I moved into the community, I realised that things were not going to be as easy as I thought. I was faced with the reality of resettlement challenges. It was very hard to understand and navigate basic resettlement issues such as neighbourhood connections, networking, and access to available services. Fortunately, there were some levels of government support from refugee services and social workers to deal with some of these challenges. For the first 6 months, Jeff and Nikki Mando were our first New Zealand family contacts from the Refugee Service Volunteers Program, and my family and I were lucky to have them. The place that made me love New Zealand was Mangere Bridge Mountain. I used to go to this mountaintop every day, enjoying the view of Auckland. I loved it because it gave me a sense of belonging, and I knew that I wanted to stay in New Zealand. I needed to find employment as soon as possible to comply with the Work and Income New Zealand policy. I felt a lot of pressure from them to find a job. One day, a staff member told me, "You need to find a job." However, getting employed was a problem. All of the potential employers asked me three questions. Do you have New Zealand qualifications? Do you have New Zealand work experience? Do you have a professional network in New Zealand? And I thought to myself that these people must be joking. How do I get these things? Can anyone get New Zealand qualifications, work experience, or connect to New Zealand professional networks in a matter of months as a new arrival? Obviously, the answer was no. I have just arrived in the country. From that time, I started to challenge myself. I was determined to improve my situation. Some questions stuck in my mind, though. Why was there no job seekers support system in place to help newcomers find jobs? In 2005, I enrolled in a language and literacy skills program at Tamaki Kiraro Training. I also took free computer courses at Mangere Town Centre. After completing these courses, I enrolled in an employment skill English course at Manukau Institute of Technology. Even though I could speak English, I also wanted to learn everyday conversational English. I couldn't speak with a Kiwi accent, and I knew I needed to speak better English. One time in our class, the English teacher gave me a newspaper. I really tried my best to find a job, but I was never called for a job interview, whether I applied online or in person. Later on, I found out that the New Zealand employers didn't hire me, not because I didn't have the skills for jobs, but because my name was different. The fact that I didn't have a professional network in New Zealand and a lack of New Zealand work experience added to my burden of trying to find a job. After finishing the employment skilled English course, I planned to start my own business, so I enrolled in automotive engineering courses. I worked very hard and completed levels 2, 3 and 4 in automotive engineering. While I was studying the automotive engineering courses, I also enrolled for a national certificate in computing levels 2, 3 and 4 at Te Wānanga o Aotearoa, which also included a national certificate in first line management and leadership. Between semesters, there were holiday breaks. During these holidays, I did not receive any student allowance, so I had to go back to Work and Income New Zealand and ask for financial support. I then found out that I was eligible to apply for student hardship benefits during the holiday period. Working in different mechanical workshops for 2 years as part of my school study was the first New Zealand work experience I got, and because work experience is not always paid work, the Work and Income Department wasn't convinced I needed support. I was wondering why there weren't any agencies available to new immigrants to help them with the skills they needed on arrival to ensure they could enter the workforce straight away. Many people come with skills. It's just a matter of upgrading to match their skills to New Zealand standards. People learn on the job. Just give them a chance. I registered with employment agencies to find any type of labour work. After applying with Adecco Employment, an agent called me in to take the test for eligibility to work in New Zealand. I passed the test and was sent to Countdown at Favona Road, Mangere in Auckland. I underwent 5 days training. I was trained how to use all types of equipment related to my work. It was a new experience for me, and when during the training a radio machine gave instructions on what and what not to do, it was funny, but an enjoyable experience. Still, I was determined to get a better education. Although I got a full-time job opportunity, I was looking for a part-time job to continue my studies. I quit the job because they gave me two choices: either work a full-time job or go to school, and I chose to continue with my education and training. My colleagues and my manager didn't want me to leave, but I told them finishing my education has always been the priority. After completing my study and community work, I was able to tick the boxes for New Zealand qualifications, New Zealand work experiences, and New Zealand professional network. I was very lucky when Auckland Resettled Community Coalition organised a workshop for leaders with Unitec. That was in 2008, and it was called Meetings Facilitation Skills for Leaders, facilitated by Ali McNichol. After training, she gave me the opportunity to join not-for-profit management, and I am thankful for that, since it moved me in a new direction. Initially, I didn't enrol in the program supported by a scholarship at the Unitec Institute of Technology because I was already studying a full-time course at Manukau Institute of Technology. It was not until 2009 that I enrolled for the not-for-profit management program at Unitec. The program could have been completed over 2 to 10 years, but I completed the training within 2 years. It was very hectic. This program added value to my New Zealand qualifications. After getting all of these qualifications, I had a much better idea of what I really wanted to do and what I needed in order to do it. I started to see the bigger picture for my career. I was able to translate the knowledge I gained into my daily life. I started working for communities. It was my educational experience that led me into community work. I was already an active member of Auckland Resettled Community Coalition. So I used my skills from my non-profit management training for community development work. In Damascus, Syria, I was Secretary General for the South Sudanese community and Chairman of the Shalok community. I came to New Zealand with the same spirit. I actively engaged the South Sudanese community members to create activities that could reduce isolation and loneliness in the community and encouraged others to get to know one another more. The majority of community members are single mothers whose husbands lost their lives in Sudanese civil wars, so community support is very important. The first administrative work I did in support of community members was to organise a World Refugee Day celebration at Potter's Park on June 20, 2006. It was a very successful event, which saw the establishment of the South Sudanese soccer team. It was because of such events that South Sudanese community members saw the need to continue engaging with one another. Our community had been inactive, but it was time to put new life into it. We called for a major community election in which Peter Kennedy, who worked at the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre at the time, helped the South Sudanese community to use the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre conference room. I was chosen to lead the community, but I chose to serve in the capacity of deputy chairman on the grounds that I was new to New Zealand. As deputy chairman, I established a lot of networking with Auckland resettlement sectors. Our community became a member of Auckland Resettled Community Coalition in 2006. Within the community, matters started arising around difficulties and challenges of raising South Sudanese children in New Zealand. Families started to complain about the negative behaviour of their children. After consultation with mothers and as a community, we agreed to have some parental programs. We were lucky enough to have the assistance of Elisa Wilson from Auckland Regional Health Services and Jenny Jennifer from Ministry of Social Development. We also received funding, and I ran the parental project for 5 years. As well, I introduced a healthy eating campaign and turned it into a healthy eating and healthy living program. These programs were aimed at bringing the community together and both yielded positive results. As a South Sudanese leader, I was a representative at Auckland Resettled Community Coalition from 2006 to 2011. In 2008, Auckland Resettled Community Coalition had a strategic direction plan and I was delegated to manage youth projects. I was responsible for youth issues and supported them within the Auckland Resettled Community Coalition. The youth project I administered gave me hands-on insights into the diversity of the Auckland Resettled Community Coalition's organisation. Engaging with individual community leaders and youth leaders was a great opportunity for me. I learned a lot from the youth and their community leaders. In 2011, after graduating with a graduate diploma in not-for-profit management, I worked as a youth worker for nearly 4 years with the Refugee Youth Action Network. My roles there were to help young people to find jobs and to help them with appropriate educational plans. Working with young people from refugee backgrounds, you Kiwis, gave me an opportunity to utilize the diversity of people from refugee backgrounds through mentoring, advising, and listening to their stories. In March 2013, I was elected chairperson of Auckland Resettled Community Coalition. And during this period, I revitalized the organization's vision and mission with the support of my good colleagues. While reflecting positively on the organization's journey of voluntary work, I was determined to remain resilient and confident in helping the resettled communities to settle well and contribute to Auckland society. The objective has been to deliver leadership, advocacy, research and information sharing and networking by working with iwi government agencies, non-governmental agencies, United Nations, High Commissioner for Refugees and international networks. I have learned so much on the needs of the resettled communities and as an active member at the national level was elected co-chair for the Refugee Sector Strategy Alliance. This gave me another opportunity to travel to Geneva for the annual tripartite consultations on resettlement in 2016. I also represented the New Zealand Refugee Sector Strategy Alliance and resettled communities across New Zealand. These roles, in local, regional, national and international levels, have given me deeper understanding of the resettlement sector and have kept my spirits high. While working at ARCC, I have been observing and hearing from community members experiencing discrimination and racism in employment, housing and work, and Income New Zealand. I experienced some of what they were trying to say, so know that this is an area where I can put my experience and skills to use in helping with these issues. Here is a story of something that happened to me. It demonstrates that a form of racism exists and emphasizes the need to change people's thinking around resettled communities in New Zealand. It was on Sunday morning on the 17th of July 2016 when I went to a family doctor at Mangere Town Centre East Tamaki Healthcare. I walked into the reception and greeted the reception with good morning. The receptionist replied back, good morning, how can I help you? I said, I came to see a family doctor. I have a pain in my left-hand side for a week now. He asked me, are you a refugee? I said, no. He asked me again, can you give me your family name, date of birth, and first name? I gave him what he asked. He responded back to me, you are not registered with us here. I asked him, how many times should I re-register each year? He answered, when you register once, you don't need to re-register again. I replied, I have been registered with East Tamaki Healthcare since 2005. My last visit was December 2012 when I travelled to South Sudan. My family members have been registered here too. Could you please explain more to me so that I can better understand your new system? He asked, where are you from and what is your ethnicity? I answered, I am from Mangere Bridge and my ethnicity is South Sudanese. He said, you are from South Africa? I responded with a question, how would you know if I am from South Africa if I am not registered with you? Finally, he said, I've found your name under the refugee category in our system, and it says you are from South Africa. I asked him again, are you relying on your system or listening to what I am telling you? I am giving you my details. You should be listening to the details that I am giving you now and correct what is wrong in your system. I continued questioning him. Do you understand the meaning of the word refugee? He didn't answer my question. I said to him, I have 7 members in my family, 3 born Kiwi kids and 2 daughters born overseas. All are New Zealanders. My wife and I are New Zealand citizens. Why are we under the refugee category? I also took the opportunity to explain to him what it means to be a refugee. If your system is labeling people according to their backgrounds or the way people look, then the system is wrong. People come to New Zealand from refugee backgrounds, but they are no longer refugees once they have settled. They are New Zealand permanent residents on their arrival, and they are eligible to get their citizenships after 5 years. Your system should treat people with respect and dignity, and as ordinary New Zealand residents. It doesn't matter what their backgrounds or socioeconomic status are. It's not correct to discriminate against someone just because of their backgrounds. I started wondering, where is New Zealand's human rights standards? I have been in New Zealand about 11 years now, yet I am still being called a refugee. Why should I remain a second-class citizen in my new home and the country I love so much? I was given a second chance in life to live in peace, and yet the health system is rejecting me and treating me as if I come from another planet. I reject anything to do with racism and discrimination. I cannot say yes to things that are not fine with me. Telling the truth is one of my cultural values. I am not a troublemaker, but a change maker and a voice for the voiceless. I have always been a proud New Zealander, regardless of my refugee background. The truth needs to be told. That's what makes us stronger and makes us who we are as a nation. I was raised in a culture where one is required to tell the truth. I have to tell the truth even if it hurts. I am now considering studying again for a master's degree in community development. I want to keep my father's dream alive. He wanted me to get a quality education before he departed this earth. I want readers to learn something from my story. I want to advise those who are struggling with jobs and life in general to pause and check the missteps. Help yourself first in order to find someone else who can help you. Seek out the opportunities and seize them, as they won't wait for you. At this point in my journey of achievement, I am proud to have accomplished successful outcomes throughout my struggle for a better life. I feel that I am indeed walking in the shoes of my father and keeping his dream alive.
Kama pembe ongeze mkia Na ukini bip tunakupigia And let me make one thing clear Bra 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 staki kusikia So simba so chui so mama Kuzi yangu inatosha kujigamba Na sina maneno kwenye kanga Kazi juu ya kazi ya ni bamba tu bamba Sa unaweza kuzaa kizaza Sisi ya na figi uchome kibanda Kalale wote ndoto zako za kitanda Si bado tuko macho mida ya wanga Funga mkanda Kaza na kamba Ama ufate yayo uchane msamba Masuwa miamba, masuwa anga Tunasema gachambua kama karanga hey! Mesha na muziki Acha maneno weka muziki Ukiwa sad, ukiwa hap, ukiwa juu, ukiwa chini Piga muziki Safari na muziki Acha maneno weka muziki Himba unachopenda na ukitaka kucheza Cheza muziki
Bambata, shika, kamata Rumba, chakata Kaboka mchizi, shadata, shadata
Nataka kukimbia na una break What do you expect? bongo, bongo kwa tabu beki. Cheza lokasa ya mbongo, uwezi kumeki. Watch yourself, sije ukaji confuse. Msuko kuruka rege kwenye bluesi. Una mchuzi, no excuse. Maisha yetu kila siku kama vile movie. Vitu vingine vitakagi ujuaji. Kajikuta unatandikia watu jamvi. Kusubiria embe chini ya mnazi. Kumwelewesha chizi, utajipa kazi. Funga mkanda, kasa na kamba. Ama ufate nyayo uchane msamba. Wasu wa miamba, wasu wa anga. Unasema gachambua kama karanga.
I am from Ethiopia. I spent the years of my youth liberating my people in Ethiopia. I joined the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a mass rebellion movement established to overthrow the communist dictator, Colonel Mengistu Haile Mariam. Initially, Haile Mariam came into power in 1978 after overthrowing the emperor, Haile Selassie, in a bloody coup. After the coup, this communist dictator ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist. He used an autocratic military mechanism that he called Derg and the rest of the world called Red Terror. He committed genocide throughout his tenure in office. He also relied on the Soviet Union for economic plans, which yielded no favorable results. Eventually, Ethiopia was hit by terrible famine. As a result of his dictatorship, Tigray People's Liberation Front and other armed forces of Ethiopia formed an alliance. In May 1991, we were able to overthrow the communist dictator. After removal of the Derg or Red Terror regime, all of the armed forces, including Tigray People's Liberation Front, merged and formed a transitional government under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front in an effort to restore democracy and the rule of law. I was honoured to serve in the transitional government under Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi Aris. I was a big man, holding an influential position in Ethiopia, but I was not happy with the government that I served. This was because there were a lot of abuses of the rights we had fought for as a nation. There was no space to speak up. Although the new Prime Minister had made a lot of economic recovery within a short period of time, he failed to deliver democracy. He used to talk about fighting for democracy and civil rights, but there was only lip service. Eventually, my unhappiness with the new regime was noticed by the intelligence apparatus, and my basic rights were breached. In 1993, I decided to flee Ethiopia. Bearing in mind that the Ethiopian government was looking for me, I asked one of my relatives to accompany me to Eritrea to avoid suspicion along the way. We both dressed up and acted like farmers and set out to the northern region of Ethiopia. We walked for 4 horrible days to reach the nearest town in Eritrea. When we arrived, I went straight to the Dikembe military base, the largest military base in Eritrea, because I didn't know anybody. I was hoping that I could get a temporary permit that would allow me to stay legally in Eritrea. Luckily, I was able to obtain the temporary permit that I needed. I had to spend days without food because I didn't have any money to buy food. I had a gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch that I could sell, but nobody could buy them. This was because the trade law in Eritrea required that I must have a receipt for anything that I wanted to sell. Unfortunately, I had no receipt. People might have thought that I'd stolen them, so nobody wanted to buy my items. In the end, I became a hungry man in the streets of Asmara, the capital city of Eritrea. I also didn't have a place to sleep. I searched for a place to spend a night, but I couldn't find one. So I went to the nearest police station to spend the night in jail. The police officer in the night duty asked me, "What do you want?" "I want to spend a night in jail," I told him. "Why? Have you killed anybody?" the police officer asked. "No, I haven't committed any crime, sir. I'm new in town and I don't know anybody. I'm flat broke. I just want to spend a night here. I'll leave tomorrow morning," I replied. He noticed that I was very weak, so he opened the door for me. "You'll sleep in a woman's cell. There are no female prisoners today," he replied, and directed me to the cell. I consented to the police officer and followed his directions. I slept on the bare, cold floor without a bed or blanket. It was an awful night. No one offered me a place to spend the night except the prison. "This is an interesting world," I said to myself as I fell asleep. In the morning, I woke up and thanked the police officer for his kindness, and then I disappeared into the streets. As soon as I stepped out of the prison, I met a shoeshiner. I have gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch with me, and I want to sell them cheap. Would you be interested? I asked. Oh, good. I want your watch. How much are you selling for? It looks expensive, the shoeshiner replied. 120 Ethiopian birr, but I don't have the receipts. Never mind about the receipts, the shoeshiner replied, and agreed to buy the flashy citizen watch. I'll give you 20 birr as a tip, I replied, after receiving the 100 birr from him. My life in Asmara was not good. I didn't feel well, and I even had a suicide plan. Eventually, I decided to look for help. I used the 80 birr out of my 100 birr to make a phone call to one of my relatives in Saudi Arabia, asking for immediate financial help. My relative immediately reacted to my situation and sent me 1,000 birr within a few minutes. I was overexcited. I felt like a millionaire. Happiness was written all over my face. My mission was to get out of Africa. By any means, I wanted to get out of Eritrea because I felt insecure. If Ethiopian authorities had ever found me, I would have been arrested or killed. I had to act quickly. I approached several embassies in Asmara to get a visa out of Eritrea. However, all of the embassies I contacted declined to provide me with a visa. It was only the Italian embassy that was willing to issue me a visa, but they wanted to charge me US$3,000, and there was no way that I could possibly afford it. So my search for a visa failed terribly. I even went to the American consulate to seek help, but the rude American senior employee didn't want to talk to me. He also looked down on me. I asked him, "Can you help me find where to go to be helped as a refugee?" "Okay, this guy will take you to the place that deals with people like you. Just follow him," he replied, and instructed one of his guys on what to do. There I met Peter Cook, the general manager of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I presented my case to him, a political refugee case. He listened to me and said, "I will first check your details in Ethiopia to make sure that you indeed ran away for political reasons." He took my details, including my job title, work address, home phone number and address. He wanted to verify whether I could be granted as a political asylum under United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Eritrea. A few days later, I was called to Peter Cook's office to be briefed about the facts he had found about me in Ethiopia. He said, "I agree with you that you have indeed escaped Ethiopia for political reasons, so I consent to provide you the protection you need." As of the 1st of January 1994, I became the first refugee in Eritrea. I was granted political asylum under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees with available and valid reasons. At that time, Eritrea was the newest nation, and a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees branch had just been established there. Peter Cook offered me a job, but I turned his offer down because I wasn't interested in working. I just wanted to get out of the vicinity of Ethiopia. It would take no time and energy for Ethiopian intelligence officers to find me in Eritrea. One time, two Ethiopian security operatives even tried to kidnap me in Eritrea's Port Massawa, and I was only able to survive with the help of my cousin. The people at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees knew my life was at risk, so I was told to go to Sudan in a manner that resembled deportation. I had no choice but to accept to go to Khartoum, Sudan, for my own safety. This was after I'd been living in Eritrea for a year and a half. This had been a difficult time, for I was also dealing with the loss of my son, who had died back in Ethiopia. Life in Khartoum was a bit better than Eritrea. I got a job with an Irish non-governmental organisation in Khartoum to support myself. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees told me that my case was preferred for Australia. Several months had passed without hearing from Australia. After a long waiting period, I finally heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. "It's so unfortunate that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sudan was so corrupted. You have to bribe the key United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees employees to get your file processed," said the officer. In 1997, I was offered a chance to resettle in Canada with three other political asylum colleagues. I satisfied all of their requirements. I met all the costs, including the medical checkup. I paid 600,000 Sudanese dollars, roughly equivalent to US$1,000. I was medically fit and everything was good. This application looked promising in every single way, but for unknown reasons the case died. By that time I felt like all of my doors were closed. I had heard that political refugee cases were processed urgently and that political asylum seekers usually got cleared for resettlement within a month by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. However, I spent 6 months staying in Sudan, and while waiting, I lost hope. Then unexpectedly, good luck knocked at my door. An interview with a woman for a chance to resettle in New Zealand. I was blown away with this great news. I didn't expect anything at this point in time. I got ready for the interview. This Kiwi woman who interviewed me was super polite. She felt sorry for me after hearing my story. Political asylum seekers do not have to wait 6 months without being given a chance to resettle. This category is always urgent, said the Kiwi woman. I finished the interview and she told me, "You will be resettling in New Zealand." I was super excited. I spent most of that afternoon reading about New Zealand online because I'd never heard of this tiny, peaceful nation. The resettlement process was also expedited. I came to New Zealand in 2000. I stayed in the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre upon arrival. After 6 weeks, it was time to move into the communities. I wanted to live in Auckland, so I talked to Housing New Zealand. However, my request was declined because I was destined for Wellington. Regardless of the decision on the resettlement location, I didn't really like how the employees of Housing New Zealand treated me in processing my case. They were so rude, but I brushed off their rudeness. Luckily, two Kiwi friends took me to their house to stay with them. This was my first taste of kindness in New Zealand. I liked the country already. I stayed with these two friends in their house in Auckland for 2 years. Life in Auckland was crazy. It was a new way of life with terrible weather. It was hard to cope. Culture shock is a big thing that affects all immigrants, and I was no exception. Although I was lucky to be able to speak English, I had to pay extra attention when listening because people here speak very fast. Searching for a job is the main headache for newly arrived immigrants. I was a certified nurse back home, but I was told that my existing knowledge and skills wouldn't matter here, especially if I'd never worked in the field in New Zealand in the last 5 years. My nursing diploma was of no use unless I upgraded it. So I enrolled for a course and found a job in a supermarket. Through my supermarket job, I earned some money. Finally, after years on the run, I was able to support my wife, whom I'd left in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. I started a process of bringing my family to New Zealand through the family sponsorship program. In 2002, my family joined me in Auckland. I was very happy. I talked to Housing New Zealand again and asked them about accommodation. Surprisingly, they acted differently this time. They provided my family with a house and we stayed together as a family once again after 9 painful years apart. I'm currently a self-employed city taxi driver. Taxi driving is good and terrible at the same time. It's good in a way that you're your own boss, but it's terrible in a sense that you can get robbed and the police wouldn't respond to your calls as urgently as possible. Sometimes a passenger wouldn't pay me because of my race, and even when I've reported an incident, no actions have been taken. There's not much protection for people of colour in the taxi business. One time, a drunken passenger vomited in my taxi but refused to clean it when I asked him to. I called the police, but when you don't talk like a Kiwi, they don't respond to your call quickly. And there's a lot of racism in the taxi business, but that doesn't override my love for New Zealand. One good thing about New Zealand is that it provides a lot of democratic spaces. You can breathe out your frustration until your lungs are exhausted. In Africa, the police are viewed as an enemy of the communities, but in New Zealand, police are the best friends of the communities. The healthcare system here is superb. Most people are very polite, although you encounter some rude people like in Housing New Zealand. But people help you when you're in dire need. One time, my expectant wife went into labour and called an ambulance. While she was hurrying to the hospital, she gave birth on the motorway. She got all the help she needed along the way. There are no such services in Ethiopia, Eritrea or Sudan. New Zealand is my home and my kids have a future here and they know it. I'll take this opportunity to thank Eritrea and Sudan for their hospitality and thank the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for the care. And for those who want to immigrate to New Zealand, I'll say that this is a great country to live, but you have to come with a clear goal and program. As long as you respect the law, respect other people and know what you're doing, you'll be good. Some people start messing up on arrival because they don't know what they're looking for in life once they get to New Zealand. They expect everything here to be a bed of roses. Francesca Marciano couldn't have put it better when he said, "When you leave Africa, as the plane lifts, you feel that more than leaving a continent, you're leaving a state of mind. Whatever awaits you at the other end of your journey will be of a different order of existence. So be prepared."
those are some of our stories, Resident Mini stories, and we will be back again next Saturday. Have a great week.
That was our show for this week.
Take care until next Saturday, same time, 10 to 5, on Planet FM 104.6.
And on the web, www.planetaudio.org.nz/resetradio.